And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's June 13th, 164th day of the year. 201 days remain till the year's over with. The war in Ukraine is still going on. According to our illustrious leader, everything wrong right now with everything is Putin's fault, Trump's fault, the war in Ukraine's fault, somebody's fault other than his. In 313, the decisions of the Edict of Milan, signed by Constantine the Great and co-emperor Valerius Licinius, granting religious freedom throughout the Roman Empire, published in Nicomedia. 1325, Ibn Battuta begins his travels, leaving his home in Tangiers to travel to Mecca. Only took him 24 years. 1381, in England, the peasants' revolt, led by Wat Tyler, comes to a head as rebels set fire to the Savoy Palace. 1514, Henry Grace Adieu, at over 1,000 tons, the largest warship in the world at that time, built at the new Woolwich Dockyard in England, is dedicated. 1525, Martin Luther marries Katharina von Bora against the celibacy rule decreed by the Roman Catholic Church for priests and nuns. Martin Luther was initially a priest, and Katharina was a nun. But there's not a whole lot known about her. 1525, King Charles I of England marries Catholic Princess Henrietta Maria of France and Navarre at Canterbury. 1740, Georgia Provincial Governor James Oglethorpe begins an unsuccessful attempt to take Spanish Florida during the Siege of St. Augustine. 1770, one of my ancestors moved down to Florida and got a Spanish land grant. And traditionally in the family, the oldest son and the patriarch, not exactly the best of buddies. So his son left. When the old man came back, when the old man died, the little town had grown up to the family land. That town is called Jacksonville. And it stayed in a lawsuit until 1950s, trying to get the land back. Crooked judges made sure it didn't happen. 1774, Rhode Island becomes the first of Britain's North American colonies to ban the importation of slaves. 1777, American Revolutionary War. Gilbert de Montier, Marquis de Lafayette, lands near Charleston, South Carolina, in order to help the Continental Congress train its army. 1805, Lewis and Clark expedition. Scouting ahead of the expedition, Meriwether Lewis, the four companions, sight the Great Falls of the Missouri River. 1855, 20th opera of Giuseppe Verdi, Las Vespras Sicilianas, the Sicilian Vespers, is premiered in Paris. 1881, USS Jeannette is crushed in Arctic Ocean ice pack. 1886, fire devastates much of Vancouver, British Columbia. 1889. Well, that's interesting. Something is always setting off my security cameras. 1893, Grover Cleveland notices a rough spot in his mouth and July 1st undergoes secret successful surgery to move a large cancerous portion of his jaw. Operation is not revealed to the public until 1917, 9 years after he died. Well, duh. 1895, Emile Levasseur wins the world's first real automobile race. Levasseur completed the 732-mile course from Paris to Bordeaux and back in just under 49 hours at a then impressive speed of about 15 miles an hour. And he was moving. 1898, Yukon Territory is formed with Dawson chosen as the capital. 1917, World War I, the deadliest German air raid on London of the war is carried out by Gotha G4 bombers and results in 162 deaths, including 46 children and 432 injuries. 1927, aviator Charles Lindbergh gets a ticker tape parade up Fifth Avenue in New York City. 1944, World War II, Battle of Villers-Bocage. German tank ace Michael Wittmann ambushes elements of the British 7th Armored Division, destroys up to 14 tanks, 15 personnel carriers, and two anti-tank guns and a Tiger I tank. 1944, World War II, German combat elements, reinforced by the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, launch a counterattack on American forces near Carentan. Also in 44, World War II, Germany launches the first V-1 flying bomb attack on England. Only 4 of the 11 bombs strike their targets. 1952, Catalina Affair. A Swedish Douglas DC-3 is shot down by a Soviet MiG-15 fighter. 1966, the United States Supreme Court rules in Miranda versus Arizona, police must inform suspects of their Fifth Amendment rights before questioning them. It's known as Mirandizing. They don't always do it. 1967, U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson nominates Solicitor General Thurgood Marshall to become the first black justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. 1971, Vietnam War. New York Times began publication of the Pentagon Papers. Now, that was when the New York Times was the New York Times and not the mouth organ of the Democratic Party. 1973, in a game versus the Philadelphia Phillies at Veterans Stadium, Steve Garvey, David Lopes, Ron Say, and Bill Russell play together in an infield, as an infield play for the Dodgers for the first time, going on to set the record for staying together for 8.5 years. 1977, convicted Martin Luther King Jr. assassin James Earl Ray is recaptured after escaping from prison 3 days before. 1981, at the Trooping the Colour ceremony in London, a teenager, Marcus Sargent, fires 6 blank shots at Queen Elizabeth II. Take the British soul, just take a dim view of shooting at the Queen.
He joined the crowd for the Trooping the Colour ceremony, finding a spot near the junction between the Mall and the House Guards Road. When the Queen came riding past on her 19-year-old horse, Burmese, he fired 6 blanks from his starting pistol. The horse was momentarily startled, but the Queen brought it under control and wasn't harmed. Lance Corporal Alec Galloway of the Scots Guard seized him and pulled him over to the crowd control barriers, where Galloway and others disarmed and subdued him. He told everybody he wanted to be famous, he wanted to be somebody. The incident happened 15 minutes after the Queen's departure from Buckingham Palace. Immediately, the sovereign's escort was ordered by the gold sticking waiting to close up around her. Queen continued to the Horse Guards parade. He said he'd been inspired by the John Lennon assassination. Well, as P.T. Barnum said, there's one born every minute. All right. In 1982, Fahd becomes king of Saudi Arabia upon the death of his brother, Khalid. 1982, battles of Tumbledown and Wireless Ridge during the Falklands War. 1983, Pioneer 10 becomes the first man-made object to leave the central solar system when it passes beyond the orbit of Neptune. 1990, first day of the June 1990 Mineriad in Romania. At least 240 strikers and students are arrested or killed in the chaos ensuing from the first Kasekeu elections.
1994.
A jury in Anchorage blames recklessness by Exxon and Capital Joseph Hazelwood for the Exxon Valdez disaster. And only victims of the oil spill to seek $15 billion in damages. 1996. Montana Freeman surrender after 81-day standoff with FBI. 1997, a jury sentences Timothy McVeigh to death for his part in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. 1999, BMW wins the 24 Hours of Le Mans, with Toyota being a contender for the win till the puncture in the last hour relegated it to second. Toyota not participating in Le Mans again until 2012. The race was also remembered for the flipping incidents involving the Mercedes. The team withdrew mid-race, and Mercedes never entered Le Mans again. 2000, President Kim Dae-jung of South Korea meets Kim Jong-il, leader of North Korea, for the beginning of the first ever inter-Korea summit in the northern capital, Pyongyang. 2000, Italy pardons Mehmet Ali Aga, the Turkish gunman who tried to kill Pope John Paul II in 1981. 2002, the U.S. withdraws from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. 2005, the jury acquits pop singer Michael Jackson of his charges for allegedly sexually molesting a child in 1993. 2007, the Al-Askari Mosque is bombed for a second time. 2010, a capsule of the Japanese spacecraft Hayabusa containing particles of the asteroid 25143 Itokawa returns to Earth by landing in the Australian outback. 2012, a series of bombings across Iraq, including Baghdad, Halia, and Kirkuk, kills at least 93 and wounds over 300 others. 2015, a man opens fire at policemen outside the police headquarters in Dallas, Texas, while a bag containing a pipe bomb is also found. Police later shot him, killed him. Of all the people to start... places to start shooting at a police station, I don't think any place in Texas is the place to do it. 2018, Volkswagen is fined in 1 billion euros over the emission scandal. 2021, gas explosion in the Zaguan district in Xi'an City in Hubei province of China kills at least 12 and wounds another 138. All right. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Anthony of Padua, Doctor of the Church, Aquinia, Cetius Peregrinus, Felicula, G.K. Chesterton, Episcopal Church in the U.S., Gerard of Clairvaux, Salmodius, Ragnabert, Blessed Thomas Woodhouse, Trifilius, Inventor's Day in Hungary, Suleiman City, Fallen in Martyrs' Day in Iraqi Kurdistan. International Albinism Awareness Day internationally. I can't read today. I don't know what the issue is. Let's see what else we got on this day in history. In 1377, Anglo-Portuguese Treaty of Alliance. That's the world's oldest existing treaty, signed in London. 1866, U.S. House of Representatives passes the 14th Amendment. 1878, Congress of Berlin begins, determines the territories of the states in the Balkan Peninsula following the Russo-Turkish War of 1877. 1392, the assassination attempt on Olivier de Clisson, Constable of France, by Pierre de Crayon, fails. 1547, King Ferdinand of Austria subjects himself on Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. 1611, John Fabricius dedicates earliest sunspot publication. 1665, the Battle of Lowestoft off Suffolk, England. English fleet beats the Dutch. 1707, Hungary declares itself independent under Ferenc Rozsáky II. 1721, England signs the Treaty of Madrid. 1727, Spain underwrites the preliminary of Paris. 1753, Austria, Great Britain, and Modena sign a secret military treaty. 1774, Rhode Island, we talked about that. 1777, Leonard Norcross patents a submarine diving suit. 1789, Ms. Alexander Hamilton serves ice cream for dessert in Washington. 1792, King Louis XVI dismisses the French government, and they later dismissed his head. 1798, the mission San Luis Rey de Francia, founded in California. 1828, military and political leader Simon Bolivar proclaimed dictator. 1837, the first Mormon missionaries to Britain, the British Isles, leaves Kirtland, Ohio. 1854, Anthony Foss of Philadelphia patents the first U.S. accordion, having made improvements to both the keyboard and to enhance the sound. Patent number 11,062. 1863 saw the Second Battle of Winchester, Virginia. 1865, President Andrew Johnson proclaims the Reconstruction of Confederate States. 1868, Oscar Dunn becomes the first African American to be elected a lieutenant governor of the state of Louisiana. 1871, a hurricane kills 300 in Labrador. 1878, the Congress of Berlin begins, determining territories of the states in the Balkan Peninsula. 1886, fire destroys nearly 1,000 buildings on this date in Vancouver, British Columbia. 1888, U.S. Congress creates the Department of Labor. 1889, 2 feet of snow accumulates in Rawlins, Wyoming. 1900, in China, Baron von Kettler, the German minister to China, beats two young boxers with his walking stick. And word of this circulates, rioting and arson spread throughout Peking during the night. 1902, the Prussian upper house gives 350 million marks to Poland. 1907, the lowest temperature ever in the 48 states for June. 2 degrees Fahrenheit in Tamarack, California. 1910, pilot Charles Hamilton makes the first one-day round trip from New York to Philadelphia. 1914, Eleftherios Venizelos, Greek Prime Minister, announced Greece intended to annex Chios and Mytilene, two large islands off the Turkish coast. Greece and Turkey had been heading towards conflict for months over claims to the Aegean Islands. 1920, on this date, U.S. Post Office announced that children cannot be sent by partial post. There had been a number of instances of this happening. I wonder what happened if you looked at a dead letter office. 1922 saw the longest recorded attack of hiccups. Charlie Osborne gets the hiccups and continues for 68 years. Died 11 months after it stopped. 1924, Benny Barak in Palestine is founded. 1924, Gaston Duméricq elected as the first Protestant French president. 1925, Charles Jenkins demonstrates the first transmission of synchronized pictures and sound. We call it television. 1930, 22 people are killed by falling hailstones in Latista in Greece. 1933, the Federal Homeowners Loan Corporation is authorized. On this day in 1933, Hermann Goering established the Gestapo, the German secret state police. 1940, on this day, Paris is evacuated before the German advance. 1942, the first V-2 rocket launch from Peenemünde, Germany, reached 1.3 kilometers. 1942, on this date, Germany landed 4 saboteurs on Long Island. Also on this day in 42, the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, is formed. 1942, on this date, the U.S. opened its Office of War Information with Elmer Davis as head. In 44, on this date, the German counterattacked on Villers-Bouguet in Normandy. Now, on this day of 44, Nazi Germany began V-1 flying bomb attacks. 1945, Orinoco Peninsula in Okinawa was captured, 6,000 casualties. 1946, King Umberto II of Italy abdicates. Okay. In 1955, a Mercedes racing car killed 77 at Le Mans in France. This day in 1956, the last British troops leave the Suez Canal zone in Egypt. 1960, Prince Norodom Sihanouk becomes head of Cambodia. 1960. All right, I think we've come to the end of our little history segment. You know, we've been talking about mysterious, unexplained deaths. Bodies found in the woods, so to speak. And the interesting thing is there's rarely any investigation, which does make you wonder. Are there entities, for lack of a better term, that exist with us that we didn't know anything about? Got a story from an individual don't really have the name. Just call him the narrator. But when he was a kid, his family moved to a townhouse in Winnetka, Illinois. And it was, the observation was made, you could tell the house had a lot of history. His mother loved the Victorian charm with ivy covering the front of the structure. She was an interior designer, and father was a history professor. So you can probably see why the place had a lot of charm for them. They relocated in the first place because the father was offered a job teaching at a private school nearby. Well, not long after they moved in, the narrator started hearing mysterious noises. Sounds were always the busiest at night when he was trying to sleep. Of course, there was always a chance they were just more noticeable during those hours due to minimal activity from the family. After all, his little sister, Jenna, was only a baby at the time. And that's a good thing, because otherwise the kid would probably have lost her mind. Always been so jumpy regarding anything remotely supernatural to paranormal. Of course, they wonder if that might be hidden trauma from things he might have seen during infancy but doesn't fully remember. And certainly that's possible. Well, if you include the basement and the attic, you could argue the old house was 5 stories high. The narrator's bedroom was on the 4th floor because there were only 2 bedrooms on the 3rd floor, and the parents needed quick access to the baby sister throughout the night. And fortunately for them, she'd always been a deep sleeper, so she rarely woke them up. And because of that, you could probably say the floor he was on was the barrier between his family and the creepy noises that, for the most part, came from the attic. Now, there were a few occasions when he thought he could hear someone moaning. And whatever was doing it, or whoever was doing it, it sounded like they were suffering, maybe from excruciating physical pain. But when he told his parents, of course, like most adults, they insisted it was nothing more than a bad dream, the wind, or the old piping throughout the house. So, like most of us would do if our parents told us something like that, he tried to accept what they said. But after a few months, the noises started happening so frequently, he eventually demanded his father go up to check things out. Now, he'd been up in the attic before, but he was sure it had only been during the day. There was a little window, so a little bit of sunlight made it nowhere near as creepy as it was after dark. Still, there was no place it could stand to be for more than a minute or two at a time. It was extra cold in the attic. That's probably around 2 in the morning when he finally got his father out of bed and got him to check on the attic. And he heard what sounded like footsteps, and he couldn't take any more, so he demanded he go check. Finally, the father grabbed a flashlight and led the way. No electrical outlets in the attic, or at least ones that functioned, so they had no to light their own path, and the attic consisted of one room. Didn't take long for his father to illuminate the space and rub it in his face. There was nothing to fear. However, as they were walking to the door, it sounded like somebody ran up behind him. And it was no question that his father heard it, because he spun around and shined the light in the direction of the noise. Strangely enough, though, there was nothing in sight. And he said that was the first time he ever saw his father scared, confused, or vulnerable. And if you knew him, you'd be hard-pressed to imagine him in such a state. Still, he did his best not to lose control in front of his son, but he muttered some silly crap about how it must have been the wind hitting the house and causing the floorboards to creak. Now, of course, that was a ridiculous theory, but the narrator understood why he wanted to act like everything was okay while in front of him. And he was curious to hear what his conversation with his mother would be after that event. Sometimes he wondered if he'd even told her. Might have been too afraid she'd think he's going crazy. And neither one of them were especially religious or spiritual, so it wasn't going to be easy to discuss that type of thing with them. And although the father had admitted that the possibility of ghostly activity seemed more than stressed on his way down the steps, clearly he was deciding how to go about dealing with this situation. And it was no mistaking what they had heard. Even the father heard the footsteps that came up right behind him, though somebody ran at him aggressively before vanishing into thin air. Well, whatever the father thought was going on, he didn't want to seem intimidated by it. He told the narrator to go back to his room, go back to sleep. And it's crazy that he was expected to carry ozone, nothing had happened. There's a few spiritual experts who would agree that it was terrible parenting to leave him as a barrier between the attic activity and the rest of the house, which certainly, at this point, seemed to be haunted. Well, it wasn't more than a day or two before he heard what sounded like somebody trying to scratch their way through the attic floorboards. Only way he can think to explain it. Father's working late that night at some kind of faculty meeting, so the mother was the only one he could approach about it. The noise had been so apparent that somebody was up there, he probably would have dropped the whole thing and not mentioned it, but this was just, frankly, one step too far. So rolling her eyes, the mother led him to the attic with her flashlight in hand. Well, almost as soon as I got up there, the light landed on what appeared to be the corpse of a red-haired young girl in a dark green pajama suit. She's lying there, face down, as though she had just been killed. The narrator and his mother freaked the hell out and ran down the steps, and the mother nearly fumbled the telephone as she dialed the police. Police arrived in large numbers and went up to the attic, apparently armed to the teeth, and found nothing. Of course, the father was disturbed to come home to a driveway full of emergency vehicles. And the parents told the narrator to go to his room while they spoke to the police, so he didn't know what they had discussed. Well, the attic noises continued for the duration of their time in the house, but they only lived there for a few more months after that incident. Parents claimed it was because the house required too much in the way of maintenance, but the narrator was sure there was much more to the story of why they moved out. Of course, it does raise interesting questions. How is it possible to have a situation where now you see the body and now you don't? It does raise quite a number of fascinating questions. When you look at something like that, there are, of course, numerous questions. And to which we have no answers. There are so many questions that you don't even know where to begin. Now, I've mentioned before the house I grew up in. Originally, the part was built in 1815. It started out as a log cabin before it became one of the antebellum homes that we've seen in the movies. I mean, they could have filmed Gone with the Wind there. It looked just like Tara. And by the time I came along, the family was much smaller, so the upstairs portion wasn't used. But certainly, growing up, I heard the sound of somebody walking upstairs. And in the strange thing, was whenever I was up there. Have you ever gone into a room and knew that somebody was there a short time before? Well, that's exactly how it felt. And when you walked to the top of the landing, there was a bedroom on either side. And one had been used by my great-grandmother. And the other, I don't know who used it, but it basically became a storage room. And then you went through a double door out onto the upper level of the porch. It was, and in the closet, you would find a primitive ladder that went up into the attic area. Now that's one area I was never able to get to, though I tried. Well, got another story. When an Airlander was a child, the family used to summer vacation in the northern woods of Wisconsin. Now, personally, I wouldn't go up there on a bet, but they'd drive from Kenilworth, Illinois to Eagle River, Wisconsin. Trip took about 6 hours. Made him feel like they'd gone far from home, although almost like they'd ventured into another dimension, so to speak. There was one night when that concept came to fruition, and you'll never forget it, he said. They usually rented the same cabin, aside from a couple of occasions another family booked it way in advance. Place sat on a magical body of water called Lower Ninemile Lake. And it was a family of four, and they'd take a rowboat out to the lake center and stargaze whenever there was a clear sky. And the parents would bring blankets and mugs filled with wine, of course. And those nights are basically stuck in his mind. Well, on this particular night, everything was quiet. They could feel the boat gently rocking in the lake, and then a sporadic loon call from somewhere on the shore. And suddenly, the older sister started screaming at the top of her lungs and fell back onto the vessel's floor. And they all assumed either a loon or some fish had popped up to the surface where she sat. But when the father said, "Oh my God," the narrator knew they had to be dealing with something serious. Well, he tried to move up to where the sister was sitting, and the mother immediately told him to stay back. He'd already seen it, though. Couldn't help but freeze up as he made eye contact with the body that was floating in the water. Drifted slowly toward him, and its head eventually hit the side of the boat. I mean, that's a sound that you very, very hard for you to get out of your mind. Sometimes lying in bed at night, he said it plays on repeat in his head, especially when he's having trouble falling asleep. The family was trying to determine whether the near bald older man in an orange t-shirt and khaki shorts was still breathing when the narrator spotted another corpse floating about 20 feet to the left. And though it was dark, he could tell the second body belonged to a child about his own age. And something about that second sighting made things so much more disturbing. That's because he was young and used to watching movies and TV shows where the kids never die. Seeing that floating child's like getting punched in the face by the chilling reality of real life. The first time he realized how vulnerable they are in this existence, no matter what the age is. Soon after observing the child, he heard a thud come from the other side of the boat. Didn't even turn around and know that what had hit the boat. Only a few moments passed before the family realized the staggering number of bodies floating in the water around them. Where had they all come from? It felt so much like some mysterious force had escorted them through the gates of hell. Even a stranger thing to know abrasions among the bodies as far as they could see. Didn't even remember seeing tears in the clothing. Every corpse they saw appeared completely undamaged. Some had their eyes open, some had their eyes closed. Some were floating on their backs, some on their stomachs. Eventually, the father came to his senses and started rowing them back to shore. The narrator remembers his mother and sister hugging each other, tears streaming down their cheeks. The mother called the police as soon as they got back to the cabin. The narrator remembered turning around and glancing at what looked like a sea of dead bodies. There couldn't have been more than 30 or 40 feet between each corpse. Most wicked-looking scene he could imagine. But how did it come about? Who or what would have dumped that number of deceased humans in that lake? Seemed like a much higher number of people than anybody would have been capable of killing without the help of somebody else or maybe explosives. And they didn't hear any loud noises that would have been explained by explosives. And they were already 5 days into their vacation at that point. Don't even remember how the mother explained the incident to the police, but it wasn't long before an officer came knocking on the door. And it was easy to tell he was perplexed regarding why he was there. narrator and his sister watched from inside the cabin as her father went with the officer down to the lake. A row of trees obstructed the view of the water, but they could see that they were scanning the surface with their flashlights. And they continued to do that for several minutes before the lights faced the house and they began walking back. Now, the assumption on the part of the narrator was the policeman had provided an explanation to his father and at least get some idea of what had happened, but it seemed the guy thought the family was, to use the legal term, batshit crazy. Wasn't the least bit sympathetic regarding how frightened they were. Came to find out they didn't see anything while they were down at the shore. According to the officer, there wasn't a single dead body floating on the surface. And he almost felt like the guy thought the family planned some kind of prank. Well, the policeman left a few minutes after he and the father returned to the house and didn't believe his parents ever charged a penalty fee or anything like that, but they tried to put it out of their mind. And he was surprised the family didn't pack up and take off that same night. What they had seen while in that rowboat is still unexplainable. How would all those floating corpses have just vanished? And where'd they come from in the beginning? None of it ever made any sense. And the narrator couldn't help but feel like some demonic entity had opened some sort of portal exposing the horrors of another dimension. Had it not been that all four of them had seen it, the narrator thought he would probably have convinced himself it was his imagination or maybe he'd gone crazy. But they all four did see it. Well, when you encounter a situation like that, it shakes your belief in the stability of the world around us. And it takes time to regain your confidence in the world as we know it. The next story was told by a narrator whose name was Haley. Had a horrible experience while trekking through the woods in New Hampshire. It happened almost a decade ago, and she was with her boyfriend, whose name was Paul, who they're now married. They often discussed the situation and even agreed to help her write the report that she eventually did. Sometimes she wakes up in the middle of the night and has trouble comprehending that it really did happen and that it's somewhat like she experiences it all over again. She ended up finding a Facebook group exclusively for people who've undergone similar situations, and that was a saving grace insofar as her mental health went. If you've ever visited Portsmouth, you'll probably know it's a beautiful but not very crowded town. And even though it thrives with tourism during the summer, it never feels like you don't have room to breathe. Plenty of lakes and rivers and walking trails in the area, making it a welcome destination for people of all ages and all types. They lived in a small apartment in Boston, so out there visiting a smaller town like Portsmouth was always welcome. Well, Paul pretended he was taking them out for brunch on their second anniversary, but surprised her with a spontaneous drive to Portsmouth. On the way there, he revealed they had booked a room and they were spending the night. She was a little annoyed she didn't get a chance to pack for the occasion, but he assured her he'd allow her time to shop for an appropriate outfit for dinner. About 4 in the afternoon, he brought her on a little wine-drinking picnic at a beautiful meadow surrounded by woods. It was a very isolated location, but she thought there was nobody else around because it was a cloudy weekend. And maybe that's why they became the target, she thought, for an extraordinary phenomenon. They'd only taken a couple of sips of wine before they noticed the odd shape in the sky. Looks like a tube initially, but when they got closer, looked a lot like the highly talked about tic-tac-shaped craft reported in San Diego and other places. A UFO, don't you know? And she couldn't emphasize how quickly it progressed toward them without making any sound whatsoever. Ship's colors blended well with the gray sky, and many folks, especially those of poor eyesight, wouldn't have even noticed it. Well, before she and her husband, or her boyfriend at the time, could exchange more than a few words, she suddenly found herself inside a white room without a door. When she turned around, she saw the bodies. It wasn't hard to tell that a mother and a young son had been abducted. Maybe the weirdest part of all was they appeared to be floating in thin air. No platforms, no wires were propping them up as far as she could see. Their arms were crossed over their chests like some folks appear lying inside their caskets. The eyes were closed, and she couldn't tell whether they were dead or merely sleeping. Now, all she saw in that room were these two folks. In fact, she didn't even feel like she could call it a room. It felt much more like a space. Not outside, not inside, and merely a space without visible boundaries. She got closer to the body. They appeared extremely pale, as all the blood had been drained from their veins. At least that's how it looked to her highly confused mind. As she examined those bodies from a safe distance, she received an awful feeling. She had the idea there was a new presence behind her. Well, she swung around to see this mysterious thin figure standing maybe 15 feet away. Although it had two legs, something about it indicated it wasn't human. A little taller than she was, but its torso, arms, legs, and neck were all skinnier than hers. And she did make the point. She was a rather slender female herself. Well, she finally said, "Who are you? What do you want from me?" Well, the figure didn't answer. "Well, she usually wears glasses," she said, so she wasn't sure if her eyes were playing tricks on her, but the thin being appeared to fade a bit as though went from being solid to translucent. Went back and forth between those two states, making the question whether she was eyeing a physical being or a hologram. Several minutes went by, she waited for it to say something, but it didn't, it just stayed silent. And then she demanded to know where her boyfriend was, the man who was just with me, where is he? Well, once again, it didn't answer. Well, a new horrible feeling swept over her, and she started crying uncontrollably. It hit her she might never see her boyfriend again. Well, after she started crying, she thought she heard a voice behind her. Oh, she heard somebody say, "Help." She turned her gaze to find the bodies were gone. It was nothing but blank space where those two bodies had been. Well, turned her attention to where the figure had been standing, and it was gone as well, but the bodies and a couple of odd-looking tubular contraptions were there. Helplessly, she watched as the bodies got lowered into these silver devices and instantly liquefied. It looked almost like they'd been put in blenders, but there was no noise of any kind. Well, she couldn't help but scream before she turned and started running, trying to find an exit. She'd only been running for a few minutes before her body froze, as if every inch of her had become paralyzed, including her eyelids. And although her eyes were closed, she noticed incoming darkness. She thought her own body was about to be liquefied, just like the mother and the little boy. And she didn't even have enough control over her muscles to scream. She didn't think it was anything more intimidating than the idea of feeling more scared than ever, but not being able to express that emotion. Well, she didn't know how much time passed, but it felt like a lifetime while her anxious brain awaited something to happen. It was nothing but silence and her own panicked thoughts. Eventually, she felt the temperature drastically change while everything became much brighter. I almost couldn't believe it as she began to regain control of her muscles. And soon she began to notice the sensation of liquid flowing along her abdomen. She was sure it was her blood and that she'd been experiencing the early yet delayed tingle of brutal death. When she was finally able to open her eyes, she saw she was lying in a stream. Fortunately, it was shallow enough that it didn't interfere with her ability to breathe. And after her senses fully adjusted, she realized she was nude. Naked. Her trembling became even more violent once she observed how Paul was still nowhere in sight. Had no idea where she was, didn't know if her boyfriend was okay. Everything happened so fast and led her to a place of staggering uncertainty. Well, she wanted to call for help, but she also wanted to avoid being seen by anybody since she was naked. Nearly fell over again after standing up, attempting to return balanced blood flow to her body. She had no way of knowing, but it felt like she'd been lying in that fetal position for quite some time. Rows and rows of trees surrounded her from both sides of the stream, leaving no clue to how close or far she was from where they had been relaxing just before everything went white. She thought she heard a couple of children giggling and approaching the area, so she took off before she could startle them, and aside from how frightened she was, the last thing she wanted to deal with was a possible public indecency charge or something like that. Well, felt like she couldn't move out of that vicinity quick enough. Jagged terrain forced her to be cautious about where she stepped, and made it around a bend in the stream when she ran into her boyfriend. He was also nude and maybe even more panicked than she was. And he called her name, and almost in disbelief as he held her by her upper arms, and the way his eyes moved suggested they were still seeking regular function. Well, she reassured him that she was she, so grateful they'd found each other and both were in one piece. And there were no words to express how good it felt just to hold each other. It was a period when she didn't think she'd ever see him again. Seemed like he wanted to stand there and break down everything that had happened to him, but the sound of children giggling motivated him to keep moving. As they progressed in a random direction, she frequently checked the sky for any suspicious and silent aircraft, although it's not as if she thought there was much to be able to do about it if they wanted to snatch him up again. Whatever they dealt with, it was clear that these things had much more technology and were much more advanced than present-day humans. Luckily, they got to the spot where they were picnicking, and their belongings were still there, including their cell phones. And they were stunned to find it was only about 50 minutes after they'd initially spotted that strange aircraft. Now, their clothing was nowhere in sight, and they were grateful the area wasn't crowded because they had to wrap themselves in a picnic blanket and kind of waddle back to the car. Doesn't think anybody saw them. Both she and her boyfriend had a lot of trouble explaining the experience to other people, including their family members. How do you put into words the horror they had dealt with? Turned out that the boyfriend had a similar experience to hers, but he didn't see any other people in that blank space. It led him to believe that they had been in separate sections of the craft. So the question was, how many rooms were there? And what did that slender figure do with the liquefied bodies? Well, there's some things you're better off not knowing. And she didn't want to discourage people from enjoying the great outdoors, but she wanted to clarify she believed we're a lot safer when in numbers. If you're a highly intelligent life form, wouldn't you be far more interested in abducting people where there are close to no witnesses around? And for all we know, that's not even a concern of theirs, but she didn't see how being around a bunch of people couldn't at least boost your chances of avoiding this sort of thing. And she couldn't help but wonder how often something like this occurs. Maybe there's a more efficient way to warn the public of potential threats like this. Sometimes she couldn't help but feel as though they were all part of some sick, twisted scientific experiment. She got the impression that she was nothing more than a mere ape to that life form, bleeding at its mercy. Wasn't a damn thing she could have done to protect herself. That was clear to her. She's also curious to know how many of our government officials have been captured by these entities. What would they even be able to do to prevent such a thing happening? She also wonders if any government higher-ups have had peaceful interactions with them. Isn't it so weird to think about they might have established some creepy agreement, maybe a treaty of some sort? It's beyond comprehension what might occur in our own backyards, especially if our government is helping them. She didn't believe it's at all possible that these intelligent life forms hunt us for various reasons, including the consumption of our flesh. What if they sell us to other intelligent species across the solar system? So many potentialities, many of which exceed the worst nightmare. She didn't think it's anything short of a miracle that the two of them escaped. She often always wondered who the family of that woman and child were. Did they have any clue what happened to their loved ones? Well, she'd be willing to bet a lot of money they still don't have any idea to this day. And that's such a shame. How many missing people cases or missing person cases are caused by these entities? Certainly, if you've had a family member disappear, that's a good road to pursue. Well, I got time to start one more story. I got about 2.5, maybe 3 minutes. This next narrator's name is Jeff, and she has a bizarre story to share. And would never blame anybody for finding it hard to believe what he went through, but he still has trouble accepting it himself. Whatever reason, thinks about it most in the morning and after waking up. Almost like he's trying to convince himself it was nothing but a dream. Well, it happened in 1996. He'd recently discovered his passion for archery with his friend Jordan. He lived in a remote Iowa town called Brownville. Wasn't much to do on those hot summer days other than exploring by foot or bicycle. And after all, they're only 11 years old, so they obviously couldn't drive cars or buy beer or chase women or anything like that. Jordan lived at the end of his block, so they'd meet up and go on adventures when they weren't playing baseball. Brownville had already been known as a very safe place, so most people didn't stress about their kids heading out on their own for hours at a time. No busy roads to cross, so they didn't have to worry about that sort of thing. So one day in June, Jordan and he came across a prairie that was just beyond somebody's fence. He must have owned at least 50 acres. That's about how far away from the house was from the fence. They could barely make out the details of the large structure without binoculars, so it was something they frequently traveled around with. Two of them had a routine where one of them would use the binoculars to locate a target, and the other would do their best to hit the target with an arrow. And they were very liberal about the number of arrows they'd lose or break because Jordan's dad was a woodworker and he used scrap to produce seemingly countless arrows. Then the prairie beyond the fence, Jordan spotted something incredible. Human arms sticking out of the ground. Looked like the poster for some Stephen King film, and that visual still haunts him to this day. They immediately concluded whoever the arm belonged to must have been murdered by the owner of the massive property. Walking off a beaten path when they found it, so they figured the owner must have chosen a burial spot that was most hidden from the nearest road. Well, at that point, we've run out of time, so we'll be back tomorrow and talk more about bodies in the woods. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.